From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Peter Brook has been internationally acclaimed for his theater and film productions of Marat Saad, King Lear, and Carmen. His 9-hour stage version of the sacred Indian text, the Mahabharata, was one of the biggest theater events of the 80s. On today's Fresh Air, Brook tells us how he adapted that epic production into a new film. Also, photographer Jan Stoller talks about exploring the desolate edges of the city and ground zero of nuclear test sites. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of songs by the late tenor Roland Hayes, the first African-American to sing with a major American orchestra. And commentator Patricia McLaughlin tells us what to wear for Earth Day. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Soviet Union's drastic cutbacks of oil and gas supplies to Lithuania today were defended by Moscow in statements that also sharply criticized American coverage of events in the Baltic Republic. Meanwhile, Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev told officials from Estonia and Latvia to pull back on their secession drives. Benjamin Rowe reports from Moscow.
In a statement released by TASS, Soviet officials said the energy measures were taken after the Lithuanian government had given no constructive answer to any of the proposals issued by Gorbachev and Prime Minister Nikolai Ryzhkov last Friday. And Foreign Ministry spokesman Vadim Perfilyev warned that further economic action was possible if the Republic did not withdraw its March 11th Declaration of Independence. Perfilyev also attacked American criticisms as inadmissible interference in Soviet domestic affairs. Earlier, Gorbachev met at the Kremlin with leaders from the neighboring Baltic states of Latvia and Estonia. Using Lithuania as an example, he reportedly demanded that the Estonians withdraw similar independence legislation and offered the Latvians a special status if they stayed in the Soviet Union. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Moscow.
Fighting in Nicaragua's 8-year civil war came to a halt today as a ceasefire went into effect between the leftist Sandinista government and the U.S.-backed Contra rebels. Under the terms of the agreement, the Contras are to begin disarming on April 25th, the same day the new government of Violeta Chamorro takes office. The Contras have agreed to be fully demobilized by June 10th. The ceasefire will be monitored by U.N. observers and by leaders of Nicaragua's Catholic Church. The Islamic group holding 3 American hostages has changed its mind about releasing one of them. The reason given by the Islamic Jihad is the Bush administration's refusal to send Assistant Secretary of State John Kelly to Damascus. Barry Schweid has more from the State Department.
President Bush, at a news conference in Key Largo, Florida, said sending Kelly to Syria would have meant knuckling under. And while Bush again told Iran, which has close ties to the Islamic Jihad, that goodwill begets goodwill, he flatly ruled out any negotiations for the Americans' release. Other U.S. officials said privately that even if Kelly didn't negotiate, just going to Syria because the Islamic Jihad demanded it would have given the appearance of dealing with hostage takers. Edward Deregian, an experienced Arabic-speaking American diplomat, cut short his participation with Kelly in a conference of American ambassadors in Germany to go back to Damascus, where he is ambassador. But Kelly, who is in charge of the State Department's Near East Bureau, is under orders to return to Washington at the windup of the conference. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Prices fell again today on Wall Street as investors reacted to weakness in the bond market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 33 points yesterday. Today, it fell another 20 points to close at 2,711. Declines led advances by 2-1. This is NPR. South African President F.W. de Klerk today outlined proposals to amend or repeal the country's major apartheid laws. He mentioned 4 laws by name, including the laws for segregated residential areas, ownership of land, segregated recreational areas, and population registration by race. De Klerk told South Africa's parliament that the laws would be repealed or amended after controls were in place to regulate the social change that would follow. Today's speech is regarded as a preview of de Klerk's strategy in upcoming talks with the country's black nationalists. Democrats today blamed the Bush administration for some of the problems plaguing the 1990 population count and said the cost overruns could be in excess of $150 million. NPR's Pas Cohen has more.
Census Bureau Director Barbara Bryant testified before the House Census Subcommittee this morning that the response rate to census questionnaires has reached 63% of households. But Bryant acknowledged it may cost more than $100 million extra to count the rest of the population door-to-door, a figure that Subcommittee Chair Tom Sawyer said could well go beyond $150 million. Later at a news conference called by Democrats, Sawyer declared the census count at risk, and Democratic National Committee Chair Ron Brown said there's only one way to make sure everyone is counted.
We think it's only going to happen if the President of the United States takes real leadership.
The Democrats said something must be done to adjust for an undercount and said it's the poor and minorities, traditionally their constituents, who tend to go uncounted. I'm Pas Cohen in Washington.
The federal government announced a proposed $5.6 million fine against Phillips Petroleum Company today. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration proposed the fine in a report that lists 575 safety violations at a Phillips chemical plant in Pasadena, Texas. 23 workers were killed and more than 130 injured in a series of explosions at the plant last year. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is theater and film director Peter Brook. Writing about him in The Atlantic magazine, Holly Brubach said, "In theater circles, Peter Brook is a guru, regarded with an awe that borders on the religious. He takes the path no one else knew was there." Brook started his theatrical career in London in the mid-40s. In 1962, he became the director of the Royal Shakespeare Company. He now directs an international stage company based in Paris. Brook adapted several of his most acclaimed theater productions for the screen, including Marat Sade, King Lear, and Carmen. He also directed the film Meetings with Remarkable Men and the 1963 version of The Lord of the Flies. For over a decade, Brook has been absorbed in bringing the Mahabharata to the stage and screen. The Mahabharata is a sacred Indian text written in Sanskrit. It's over 2,000 years old and over 10 times the length of the Bible. It's part myth, part history, part religious text, telling the story of the creation of mankind. The film opens in New York April 27th and in selected cities at the end of May. Peter Brook told me how he first encountered the Mahabharata.
I was doing a show in London about this country called US, which was about the Vietnam War, and we called it US Us because it was about the relation between the English and the Americans and Vietnam. And we were all very concerned at that time, and one day a young Indian came into rehearsal and dropped into my hands a tiny play he had written, and I looked at it, and it was just about one incident. I didn't even know at the time that he came from the Mahabharata, which was about a great general who, just as he's about to give the signal to launch a battle that could lead to the extermination of all mankind, stopping in his tracks and asking himself this great question, why should we fight? And we wanted to incorporate it in our show, and we couldn't, but this powerful image remained with me, and then gradually over the years I learned, first of all, that this was the center of the great sacred book of India called the Bhagavad Gita. And then Jean-Claude Carrière, the writer who was working with me in Paris, and I learned from a great French Sanskrit scholar that the Bhagavad Gita, in its turn, is just the culminating point in an enormous epic poem called the Mahabharata.
Did you ever end up going back to the text itself and reading it in English translation?
Oh, of course. So after this, Jean-Claude Carrière, we were both very excited by this, and he was fired to write a play, and he wrote a short play entirely based on what we'd heard. We looked at it and then realized that this was just a sketch. We had to go into it more seriously, and then began many years of work where we sat together and read through the entire 18 volumes in English translation, the same in an incomplete 19th century French translation, and then read many different shortened versions, went to India, compared versions, talked to scholars, talked to people in the street, listened to storytellers, and gradually, in that way, got sufficiently drenched in the material for Jean-Claude 10 years later to begin to write the full script. And we made one vow. We said we're not going to fix a time limit, either on the time it will take to write it or the time that the show should take. We will let it find its natural shape. And its natural shape was 9 hours. And its natural divisions were in three parts.
Yeah, the theatrical version was 9 hours. I mean, a theatrical production of that length has certain advantages in the sense that you clear away everything else from your life to go see this because you have to create a whole day. It becomes an event, a kind of holiday from life to immerse yourself in this theatrical event. On the other hand, there's certain disadvantages. First of all, who has the time to do that? And it takes a certain physical stamina to spend most of the day sitting in one chair in a theater. What were your considerations about producing something of that length, both in terms of what it would take out of the actors and what it would require from the audience?
I didn't give a thought to either of those. I only thought of one thing, which is that the Mahabharata is a great and important work, and suddenly we're in the privileged position of being able to bring it to people who don't know anything about it, after which Darwin's laws of natural selection operate, that in each city where we played it, it was always crammed to the roofs by natural selection. In other words, there were people, and I would be one of them, I think, if I'd been just a member of the public, would say, oh my God, I can't go to a theatre and sit there for 9 hours. I wouldn't have gone to see that if I hadn't been connected with it. And many people followed the line of thinking you've just brought up and said, we won't go. But luckily, there were other people who said, this interests us, this attracts us, we are going to make the effort. And always, when you make an effort, you're rewarded.
Theater and film director Peter Brook is my guest, and his theatrical production of the Mahabharata has just been adapted into a new film version. This isn't the first time you've brought one of your theater productions to film. Can you discuss some of your considerations when you're adapting something you've already done on stage? You don't want to just film the stage production.
No. I mean, the first thing is to realize that it's a completely different medium, it's a different language. And I've always enjoyed it. I've always found it a very, very fascinating technical challenge. In a way, if you're taking a subject and starting from zero, which I've done in other films, you construct the whole film in a quite different way. If you're starting from something that has already had existence in the theatre, first of all, you have a great leap ahead because you've got something that's been well prepared. The actors are well prepared. Lots of the scenes have been really worked over and brought into their best form. So there is a good starting point. On the other hand, it is in theatre form. So what's one trying to do? Now, when I made the film of the Mahabharata, of the Mara Sad, the aim was to see how one could put onto the screen the sensation of being in the audience, not what it would be like to stick a camera in the stalls, because if you stuck a camera in the stalls, you wouldn't get the sensation of being in the audience. You'd just see a flat picture, which would give you everything except that sensation. So here we had to use highly cinematic devices with a camera constantly on the move and a very complex cutting structure to give the physical sensation of being part of that performance. Now, the Mahabharata is slightly different because the Mahabharata is a narrative. And what I wanted to do was I chose to do it in a studio rather than on real locations to be able to capture something that goes right back to the origins of the cinema, which is that particular thing that only a film studio can give as a dream factory, a form of cinema such as, what can I say, there have been many studio films going right back, say, to The Wizard of Oz, that are not realistic and at the same time are not theatre. They're part of that particular great magic of the cinema which belongs to studio. And that was the basis on which we made the Mahabharata film.
Now, your movie, The Mahabharata, is 3 hours, whereas the stage production was 9 hours. Is the scaling down in time economical, or does it have to do with the differences between theater and film?
There are two versions. There is a television version of 6 hours, which is going to be aired, I think, in a year's time, and which has been shown already all over the world, and specifically film version. The 6 hours is exactly the same, really, as the 9 hours, surprisingly. There you see the difference between theatre speed and film speed, that exactly the same scenes, just because you're in closer with the actors don't have to walk in and walk off. The fact that you can cut right into the middle of a phrase in the cinema, and the fact that because you're in big close-up, everything can be done with less force, and consequently it all goes quicker, means that you can lose a couple of hours without even cutting a line. And with little trimming, we got 9 hours down to 6 hours with no problem. Then came the other challenge, which was to make a purely cinematic film. And here the approach was different. It was no longer trying, as in the full version, to tell the whole story. It was to give a very, very intense impression of what the Mahabharata is. So I'd compare it much more with finding yourself in the center of a maze or of one of those hall of mirrors in fanfares, where you see an extraordinary amount of strange images leaving you in different directions. And the aim is not to spell everything out. The aim is to give you a quite bewildering, kaleidoscopic, but very intense impression of what this great, almost unknown, many-leveled work from several thousand years ago called the Mahabharata is.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your work in stage and film. And my guest is director Peter Brook. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Theater and film director Peter Brook is my guest. His films include the 1963 version of Lord of the Flies, Meetings with Remarkable Men, and the screen adaptations of his theater productions of King Lear and Marat Saad. His new film, The Mahabharata, is adapted from his 9-hour play, which dramatized the sacred Indian text, The Mahabharata. There's a lot of talk today about multiculturalism and multiculturalism in the arts. Back in 1968, you formed an international theater group in Paris, which you still had, the International Center of Theater Research.
Yes.
And you've been working with actors from around the world. I think 36 countries are represented in the cast of your new movie. What was it you wanted to learn by creating such an international cast to work with?
Something very simple. I feel that all of us, every human being, is incomplete. And the world's tragedies come from the moments when we think that we are complete and everybody else is incomplete. But the moment we realize that we're all unfinished bits in a giant jigsaw, we can see that there is something infinitely precious that we can gain if we can make a living and working relationship with people very different from ourselves. If we're with people who are very much like ourselves and we have the same beliefs, the same ideas, we become a clan and eventually an arrogant clan that really does believe that it's complete. If we're with people who in every way are different but whom we can respect because we see that they are human beings like ourselves, but they have different possibilities, a different understanding. Their strengths are different from ours. Their weaknesses are different from ours. Then through a very hard, specific program, which is of working together, not just sitting loving one another and making universal brotherhoods, but hard, practical work for a purpose, which is, say, producing a play so that people can actually pay money to go and see it. When you have that to bind you together, gradually these incomplete bits open up and something is shared by everyone and each person is enriched by the experience. And so is the result.
Let's talk practically for a minute, though, when you have people from different countries who represent different languages, who will have different accents when they speak English, who, because of their skin tones, are obviously from different cultures and different parts of the world. Can you create a naturalistic play where everybody's of the same family or everybody's from the same background? Do you know what I mean, if that's required of the text?
I think that this is the real and extraordinary miracle that the theater can achieve, that ever, all through history, when acting has been powerful enough, it can sell anything to an audience, and the audience is delighted to buy it. The simplest example is that many old actresses, and particularly one reads Sarah Bernhardt when she was old and had a and limped, still managed to convey to an audience that she was a young girl or that she was a young man by the power of her acting. And the moment that you sweep away this very, very false notion that has only recently crept into the theatre, that the theatre should be like a photograph of everyday life, and you realise that theatre is a platform or a space in which an actor is like a storyteller, conjuring up something for the imagination of the audience, you can see that an old man can play a young girl, that a black man can play a young white man, or a Japanese can play an English hero, that these all depend on the power of the talent and the conviction of the actors. When this succeeds, the audience is touched in a new way.
Film and theater director Peter Brook is my guest. When you got out of college, you wanted to make movies. You wanted to direct, but you ended up directing theater first instead of film. Why did you want to do film over theater, but why did you end up actually starting in theater?
I've always liked films. I mean, it's been my first great passion along with photography, and it never occurred to me for a moment that I'd work in the theater. I've made a film when I was at college, when I was, I think, 18 or 19, and then went into films, and I worked in films as various sorts of assistant, but all I wanted to do was to make my own film. And I went from one producer to another, but particularly in those days, nobody would dream of giving a 19, 20-year-old young man a film to direct. And I was impatient, very impatient. And I turned to the theatre as a sort of quick, cheap substitute. And even there, it wasn't easy because the big theatres said exactly the same thing. They said, come back another day, come back when you've done something somewhere else. Until in the end, I found a theatre so tiny where the production cost was so low that they really took no risk at all in letting an unknown young man do a play there. And from then onwards, that has really been the balance. I mean, I have, in the course of it, got as interested, as passionately involved as in the theatre as in the cinema, but what has made it possible for me to do about 60 productions in the theatre and make 10 films is that, as I've never wanted to do a commercial film, and I've always wanted to do just the subjects that interested me, as in the theatre I can get, could always get, a project going in a few weeks, and the same sort of project in the cinema would take a few years.
So you never wanted to make conventional movies? You never wanted to do a Western or a detective story or
no.
a comedy?
No, I
romance.
Love going to see them.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I've never wanted to do what I've seen other people do well.
You thought you had something else that was your calling?
Yes. When I've seen a Western, I've seen marvelous Westerns, and having seen, say, John Ford make a Western, the last thing I want to do is to go into rivalry with him. I'd rather go and see one of his films once again and do something quite different.
We've mentioned theater and film. You've also directed a lot of operas, but I think you kind of left opera a while ago.
Slamming the door.
Yeah, why?
I left opera for something like 25 years until we did Carmen.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was very simple. I realized that in the conditions of big opera houses, it was impossible to do really good work because there's a system. And a system is like a political system. It's like a system that's been in Eastern Europe, that if you had a choice between becoming a bureaucrat in Eastern Europe or going your own way in the West, I think that very few people would deliberately choose to become a bureaucrat in Eastern Europe. And in exactly the same way, if you have a free choice between directing in sympathetic, good, quiet conditions with actors who are interested, who have egos but are not dominated by them and who really wish to share their work to make a good result, or to go into the opera house where you have impossibly short rehearsals, union clashes all the time, hysterical, over-important, ego-devoured singers, unwilling to rehearse, greedy because they can get more money by rushing from one part of the world to another with a minimum of rehearsal, doing the maximum of high-powered, of highly overpriced performances, you realise that you must be mad to prefer to work in those rotten conditions than to work with them. On the other hand, opera is a great form, and singers can be marvellous people. So I made a very simple vow. I would never work in a great opera house, but I would do an opera the moment it was possible to bring together a group of really dedicated young singers and musicians within our own theatre, where we have none of these horrifying structural blocks that almost every big institution is bound to suffer from, whether it wants to do so or not.
When you were at Oxford University, you founded the Film Society there. What did you do in it?
First of all, we showed films. We showed great silent films that people had heard about, you know, the great Russian films and the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and the Dreyer films and Murnau films that we knew about as legendary pictures, but we had no other way of seeing. And then we made a film. We made a film called A Sentimental Journey from Lawrence Stern's book, which we shot in the middle of war with incredible difficulty, with the only film we could find, which was rejected camera gun film that the RAF didn't use, so they just sold a sort of bulk lots of sort of largely dud negative. And in wartime, it was forbidden to use any laboratory for amateur work. So I found a little man in London who was illegally making pornographic films. And so to do this, he had to have his own laboratory because he couldn't send his films to anyone else to process. And I came to an arrangement with him to develop our films for us. And it was in those sort of conditions we made our first film.
That's interesting. Did you ever watch his movies?
No, but he was a very sweet man, and he kept saying to me, one of these days I must show you. He'd look at our film, and he said, that's very good. I'm sure that one of my films you would enjoy most of all, which was called Wood Nymph, and this became a legend. He'd always say to me, well, Mr. Brooke, he said, one of these days I'll show you Wood Nymph, but I'm afraid he never did.
I have one last question for you. What's your prescription for a healthy theatre?
To stop thinking that the theatre can be even discussed in these broad generalizations.
Uh-huh.
Each single act of theatre is a new event, and what's healthy is to make the most of that event without ever imagining that the theatre as a whole is going to get better or going to get worse or change its direction, because the theatre as a whole is always going to be an extraordinary mixture, a great hodgepodge in which each person can only take responsibility for his little corner of it and cultivate his own field as best he can.
My guest has been theater and film director Peter Brooke. His latest project is the film adaptation of the play Mahabharata. He directed the theater and film productions. It's based on the sacred Indian text. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air. Next time, Alan Berube. He's the author of a new book called Coming Out Under Fire, The History of Gay Men and Women in World War II. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet photographer Jan Stoller. After years of photographing desolate and abandoned parts of New York City, he went to the lands of ultimate desolation, ground zero of old nuclear test sites. One of the many moving moments in civil rights history was Marian Anderson's performance at the Lincoln Memorial. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new collection of vintage performances by the late tenor Roland Hayes, an African-American who helped pave the way for Anderson. And Patricia McLaughlin wonders if there's anything politically correct to wear for Earth Day. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Lebanon, a pro-Iranian kidnap group says that it's postponed the release of an American hostage because the U.S. did not meet one of its demands. Yesterday, the Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine promised to free within 48 hours one of its three American hostages. Mike Theodulu has more on the story.
The group says it's delaying the release because the U.S. failed to send State Department official Roger Kelly to Damascus to coordinate the release. The State Department said earlier it didn't want to send Kelly in case it looked like the U.S. was dealing with kidnappers. The kidnappers said they were now waiting until the picture was clear. They also hardened their tone by repeating a threat made last month to strike at airlines and airports used to transport Soviet Jews to Israel. The statement appears to dash hopes of an imminent hostage release, though it's likely the group is trying to draw out the affair to capitalize on its publicity value. And the group does seem to be playing games. Its first statement was accompanied by a photograph of one hostage, Jesse Turner, which led people to believe he'd be the lucky one, but the later statement came with a picture of another hostage, Robert Polhill. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
Syria's foreign minister says that his government has been exerting a great deal of influence to get the release of an American hostage by Sunday. At a news conference today in Florida, after meeting with President Mitterrand of France, President Bush reacted to news that the hostage release was delayed because the U.S. was not sending a diplomat to Syria as the kidnappers had demanded.
We do not meet demands. Our ambassador to Syria is back in Syria. We've been disappointed before, hopes raised, only to have them dashed by excessive speculation. I would add that we are not talking to the hostage holders. I would further add, we are grateful to Syria for trying to play a constructive role in what is going on.
And the president also said that he and Mitterrand are deeply disturbed by recent Soviet steps to disband a move toward independence in Lithuania. Mr. Bush said that he is considering appropriate measures to be taken in light of Soviet actions. Moscow toughened its energy embargo against Lithuania today. According to officials in the breakaway republic, natural gas supplies have been sharply curtailed after the flow of crude oil was stopped. Last Friday, Soviet leader Gorbachev threatened to cut off supplies to Lithuania unless an independence declaration was rescinded. Officials in Lithuania estimate there is enough oil to last for up to 3 months. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 21 points to close at 2,711.94, on volume of some 153 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The first major African-American classical concert singer was tenor Roland Hayes, who died in 1977. His success, both popular and artistic, paved the way for Marian Anderson and the other black stars who followed. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new Hayes compact disc that he says has been long overdue.
Garde de pâte mulette là, Mr. Banjo, comme un lien solo. Chapeau sur côté, Mr. Banjo, cigare dans la grande bouche de banjo. Mouchoir dans la poche, Mr. Banjo, la canne dans la main. Oh, garde.
Roland Hayes was born in 1887 in Curryville, Georgia, on the very plantation where his mother had been a slave. He did his first singing in the Baptist church his mother founded. As a teenager, he heard a recording of Enrico Caruso and decided to be a singer. He was admitted to Fisk University on the basis of his singing, even though his formal education had stopped at the sixth grade. On tour with the Fisk Jubilee Singers, he decided to stay in Boston and study voice. Later, he studied in Europe. In 1921, after a concert at London's Wigmore Hall, the royal family invited him to perform at Buckingham Palace. A year later, Roland Hayes became the first black performer to sing with a major American orchestra, the Boston Symphony. He became his own concert promoter because he couldn't find a professional manager to represent a black artist. In 1924, he gave his first concert in Berlin. When he walked on stage, the audience began to hiss. He stood there in silence until they finally calmed down. Then he sang Schubert's Du bist die Ruhe, You Are Quietness. At the end, they cheered. Here's Roland Hayes singing the same song, recorded at Boston Symphony Hall in 1955. Hayes was 68 years old when this recording was made, but you can hear what impressed the Germans 30 years before. The hushed restraint of his pianissimos, the sustained rapture of his phrasing, dissolved the boundary between prayer and love song. Hayes wanted to compete with the world's great lead singers on their own turf, but he never neglected the music that first inspired him. He was surely the first serious artist to bring spirituals to the classical concert stage. This recording of Weepin' Mary was made in 1942. This album, The Art of Roland Hayes, which was just issued by Smithsonian, includes a fascinating variety of material. Hayes sings elegant versions of English songs from the 16th through the 20th centuries, including Haydn's great setting of Viola's lines from Twelfth Night, She Never Told Her Love. There are songs by Beethoven, Schubert, Schumann, and Berlioz, an exuberant Creole folk song called Mr. Banjo, an African fetish chant set by Villa Lobos, and 10 folk songs, slave songs, and spirituals, most of them in Hayes' own superb arrangements. The earliest of these recordings were made in 1939, the last at Hayes' 80th birthday concert at Boston's Gardner Museum in 1967. All of them are eloquently accompanied by Reginald Boardman. Hayes' daughter, Afrika, joins him in two numbers, including this charming Mendelssohn duet recorded in 1965.
Forget me not and speed me like a violet sweet and shy. Forget me not and speed me like.
and bite.
Violet, sweet and shy.
Forget me not and speak well, like and bite.
Violet, sweet and shy.
Hayes has one of the warmest tenor voices ever recorded, a sound unmistakable even into his 70s. Occasional rough spots crop up, even on his earlier recordings, but his flawless diction, his stylistic assurance and integrity, and the utter conviction of his delivery set towering standards for future generations of American singers.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed The Art of Roland Hayes on the Smithsonian label. This is Fresh Air. An eerie feeling of abandonment haunts the photographs of Jan Stoller. He chooses forbidding areas of the city, deteriorating streets, shut-down highways, rotting piers, piles of rubble. Some of his photos, shot around New York City, are collected in his 1988 book, Frontier New York. His latest series of photos was taken at places of ultimate desolation, ground zero of old nuclear test sites. His pictures show the remaining domes and bunkers that were built to withstand the nuclear blasts. He visited several nuclear testing grounds in the West last summer with the permission of the Department of Energy. The idea came to him after he finished an assignment for Life magazine taking pictures of uncompleted and shut-down nuclear reactors.
Having seen what wonderful engineering projects they were, they're quite monumental sculptural presences which take on a quality quite apart from what their engineering purposes were. Inasmuch as they're not being used, they take on this other function, or rather functionless existence. And I thought those were quite impressive. There was another aspect that I was also thinking of, which was how would these things appear to another culture that might possibly discover these things long after their original purpose was forgotten, and inasmuch as they were so large, they were likely to survive and exist, much in the way Stonehenge is now baffling us today. We sort of speculate as to what its purpose is, and the way we've had to fathom what the pyramids were built for, and Mayan ruins.
What did you feel when you were standing there with your camera at ground zero at several of these test sites?
Well, it was, the most appropriate word would be awesome, even though it's a overused expression. And yet, we know that this was the site of a tremendous physical force, man-made, and it was very haunting. And it was also somewhat unnerving, what with the ambiguous amount of lingering radiation. So there was the question as to whether we were being exposed to radioactivity out there, particularly tramping around in the dust, and the thought that one speck of plutonium is enough to cause cancer should it be inhaled. And sometimes we'd have to set our equipment down on the lake bed floor. And there again, I was wondering if somehow we were going to take back with us radioactive material. So there was that sort of gamble.
Before you started doing this series of Ground Zero photographs, you did a long series of photographs of pretty sinister urban landscapes, of places that were abandoned or dilapidated. What got you going on that?
I think that I'd always been drawn to abandonment. And that probably goes right back to my childhood, when even living in Long Beach, Long Island, there was the Lido Beach Hotel, which was when closed for the season, was completely abandoned, and that was always a fascinating place to roam around in winter afternoons. It was just devoid of any kind of life, and so it somehow had some kind of mystery to it. It suggested that there had been people there, and yet there weren't any there. When I moved to New York in 1976, I had, at the end of the day, wanted to get out and get some sunlight, living in a rather dark loft in the middle of Manhattan. And I would go out to the West Side Highway, which at that time was abandoned. And it was 5 miles of highway that stretched from the Battery Park to 59th Street, and sometimes 72nd Street. So it was an elevated highway that was accessible only to bicyclists or joggers or hikers. And I used to just go out there for some peace and quiet. And those were the beginning photographs that I had done for the book Frontier New York.
Yeah, the West Side Highway at the time was abandoned. Cars were banned from it, and it was slated for demolition. And you started photographing it right before the demolition and photographed it into some of the demolition. I want to ask you about some of your photos from that period. There's a photograph of an abandoned ramp of the West Side Highway, and you see the concrete Art Deco trims on the side, but the ramp is completely littered with rubble and with sand, and you can tell it's been quite a long time since a car has been there. It's a very eerie and very creepy image. I wonder what attracted you to that shot.
The picture you describe was as a result of, it was, we should say, taken at twilight. So the illumination in that picture is primarily in the foreground that of available streetlight. And I found myself staying out later and later, particularly as the days grew longer in this time of year. And the reason that was because it was, the city is actually quieter at that hour. And I was quite intrigued with what happened when the city began to get dark, because unlike being out in a city, rather out in a location without artificial light, the city would never really get dark. The only thing that would happen would be the sky would get darker, and so somehow then the foregrounds illuminated by streetlight would magically become more intense. And people have likened the photographs to being stage sets, and in that way, the foregrounds were magically lit by what looked like to be a stage light.
Some of your photographs really capture the disorder of lonely urban places. Like, you have one photograph of a street by the Hudson River where there's a stack of mattresses in the middle of the street. It's the kind of thing you sometimes run into in a city. It's eerie. You don't know what it means. You don't know who's using it or why it's there.
That picture was taken about 2 in the morning. I had dinner on the Upper West Side and taken the car, which is not something I often do. And so I was driving from about 80th Street on down to below Canal, where I live, and I had taken the highway. And it had been a very warm, damp evening after a very cold period of time where the river had been frozen over for a few weeks prior to this warm weather, and all the moisture had condensed out of the air, and it was a very heavy fog, and there were all these mysterious things happening as I drove back about midnight. And so I went back and I got my camera, and I just went back as far as 72nd Street and started photographing. And there are three photographs from that night in the book, and in each one there's this heavy fog. And the subsequent picture, which is also in the book, is of a salt storage warehouse, which after I had finished taking the picture of the mattresses, which these were about 8-minute exposures each, two I had done, I turned around and there was this magnificent shaft of light penetrating the fog coming out of this warehouse. And the kind of things that happen with these ephemeral situations, whether they be light, weather, or some other phenomena, are the kinds of things that I'm most interested in my photography.
You know, just about every photo of yours I look at of the city, I say to myself, now there's a place I wouldn't want to go alone at night. There's a place I wouldn't want to go alone even during the day. So I'm wondering if you were ever mugged while taking your photographs.
Knock on wood. I haven't been. I would say one thing about the places I went was that I was the only person there, particularly in bad weather. I just don't think it's the right kind of weather for muggers to be out. And since they were such quiet places, I tended to rely more on my hearing than on my eyesight, because quite often I was concentrating on making the photograph, whether it just be juggling equipment or viewing the scene.
Do you feel that in a way what you're doing in a city is some kind of weird equivalent of nature photography?
Well, particularly the work of the West Side Highway, I thought that that my experience of the city was a rather naturalistic experience, because even though these were hard, man-made, and to some people's eyes rather ugly structures, they still were on the earth, in the environment, under the sky, subject to the weather. And as the years went by, I would go out in all kinds of weather. And it might be a blizzard, or it might have been that fog or rain. And certainly in a blizzard, for example, that picture of the Manhattan Bridge with this snow-covered bridge in the foreground, absolutely devoid of any trace of people. The only mark on the snow happened to have been my ski tracks. I had cross-country skied across the Manhattan Bridge, which connects lower Manhattan to Brooklyn, and I had done this about 1 o'clock in the morning on a blizzard, and it was a rather fierce wind, and I was totally encrusted in ice, you know, from the blowing snow, and so it felt very much like a snow expedition anywhere else.
Photographer Jan Stoller. His photos of nuclear test sites will be shown at the Lieberman and Saul Gallery in New York from April 22nd until May 19th. His photos taken over a 10-year period in New York are collected in his book Frontier New York, published by Hudson Hills Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. What's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. More on the continuing saga of Lithuania, the Soviet republic that wants to be independent. Lech Wałęsa presides over the Solidarity Congress meeting in Gdańsk, Poland. And there's the question, will Wałęsa run for the presidency of Poland? Linda Wertheimer talks with William Riley, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. And a very unusual story this evening about some unwanted pigeons who now reside in Glen Echo. It's an old amusement park just outside of downtown Washington, D.C. The pigeons, about 150 of them tonight, that aren't wanted there anymore, will be trapped and transported to an as-yet undisclosed location, but it probably won't be Philadelphia.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Most participants in the first Earth Day 20 years ago wore some variation on jeans and a T-shirt. But what do you wear to Earth Day 1990? Commentator Patricia McLaughlin notes that environmental chic is one of the hottest fashion trends going now, but she wonders what's it really all about.
Yes, Mother Nature is really in now. Jewelry made of sticks and stones and recycled glass, leopard prints, earth tones. Last month, Vogue showed models wearing moss, twigs, and starfish. And a New York Times story on the greening of fashion featured a wristwatch whose design incorporates a little bitty terrarium planted with live moss and ivy that actually need to be watered. Hermès, the French leather goods company, has come out with a silk scarf printed with South American endangered species. London designer Catherine Hamnett's latest message T-shirt warns, "Clean up or die." I think it's nice that fashion cares, but I'm afraid a lot of this stuff misses the point. I'm not sure wearing starfish really helps that much. Starfish belong on the beach, not on some Vogue model. The thing is, if you're serious about saving the planet, you ought to care more about what your clothes do to the environment than what they say about it. For starters, are they biodegradable? If you care about the Earth, it's probably a mistake to wear anything that won't rot. This is a problem that goes way beyond disposable diapers. Thousands and thousands of years from now, archaeologists will be digging plastic cowboy boots and platform shoes and polyester leisure suits out of landfills and thinking what tacky taste we had. Synthetics just don't make it. So what can you wear with a clear conscience? Rayon, which is made from wood pulp, would be okay if the people who make it waited for the trees to die of old age. But they don't. You can't get more natural than silk. It's spun by silkworms. But to get the silk, you have to kill the worms, which seems a little insensitive. Some animal rights activists think wool is just as immoral, since sheep don't exactly volunteer to be shorn. So what about cotton? It's a vegetable, right? What could be wrong with it? Well, just the other day I was reading how it takes loads of fertilizer and pesticides to make it grow, and it really depletes the soil. I don't actually know anything bad about the process of growing flax, but the trouble with linen is you spend your life ironing it, which seems wasteful, not only of electricity, but of your life. Theoretically, cashmere has possibilities. The best cashmere comes from China, where, instead of shearing their cashmere goats, they just comb them regularly to remove loose fibers. That's about as non-exploitative as you can get. Unfortunately, it makes the cashmere so expensive that a single 2-ply cashmere Save the Whales t-shirt would take a whole paycheck. So what are you supposed to wear? Fig leaves? Is there something wrong with everything? Well, yes. The thing is, for all the talk about the greening of fashion, it's an unnatural match. The whole point of fashion is to promote consumption. But what environmentalists want is conservation. The only place I can think of where the two overlap is in the miniskirt. I'm sure it's completely accidental. But one thing you can be sure of with the tiny skirts designers are pushing for next fall, whether they're made of silk or wool or cotton or polyester, at least they don't use much of it.
Patricia McLaughlin is a syndicated columnist who writes about style for the Philadelphia Inquirer magazine. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Dan Lachlan, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Gays and lesbians are prohibited from serving in the American military. On the next Fresh Air, historian Alan Berube examines current military policy and takes us back to World War II, when screening procedures to keep out homosexuals were first created. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, Miami Blues. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.